John 6:42. What does that mean? In the context of John chapter 6, just prior to this verse, Jesus has talked about being the bread come down from heaven. And at that point, some of the Jews, which at this particular, in the Gospel of John, in particular when he speaks pejoratively of, or negatively of the scribes and Pharisees and other religious leaders, he simply calls them the Jews. So it's not the whole crowd, and it's not all Jewish folks, it's the religious leaders here who have raised questions and who have a problem with what Jesus has said. And then in verse 42, they were saying, "Is not this Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know? How can he now say then, 'I've come down from heaven'?" So the verse here, and I do not know who typed this and put it in, and I hope if you're here this evening that I hope you're here this evening, but if you are, I hope that I get to your question about that particular verse. What does it mean? I'm going to go in a couple of different directions here. Of course, it's always difficult to pull one verse out of context. Well, it is for some folks, and some folks make a whole sermon off of it. But it's always difficult to pull one verse out of context and say, okay, here it is, this is exactly what it means. But I think very possibly the question coming about here is a question that was raised by the religious leaders about Jesus' earthly lineage. We know who his parents are, so how in the world can he talk about coming down from heaven? And using that to try and cast aspersion on what Jesus was teaching. That's what I think, or where I think the question may be going. If not, and you're here tonight and you don't mind correcting me, correct me and we can go in a different direction. But here, these religious leaders, when Jesus earlier has been talking about, "I am the bread of life, come down from heaven." First of all, he talks about that, and then he raises questions to those who are around him about their unbelief. He takes it to a personal level, and he said, if I'm the bread of heaven and I'm the one that gives life from God, and you don't believe in me, then there's a problem here. And rather than take that personal look within themselves, they turn around and try and attack Jesus and raise questions about his veracity, raise questions about how in the world can he talk like this when we know where he comes from. From Nazareth, and nothing good ever came out of Nazareth, as one of the disciples said early. You know, can anything good come out of Nazareth? And so here they're raising that question about his parentage. They're saying, we know where he's from. So how in the world can he say these kinds of things? It's very similar to what happens in Mark chapter 6, verse 3. Where in Mark chapter 6, verse 3, we have Jesus' rejection when he's preaching at Nazareth, his hometown. He left that place and came to his hometown, verse 1, and his disciples followed him. On the Sabbath he began to teach in the synagogue, and many who heard him were astounded. And they said, where did this man get all this? What is this wisdom that has been given to him? What deeds of power are being done by his hands? Is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary, and the brother of James, and Joseph, and Judas, and Simon, and are not his sisters here with us? And they took offense at him. So, in that particular instance, when Jesus is preaching, once again, when Jesus is giving this teaching, there is a question raised about his lineage, which to them negates any truth to what he's saying. In other words, they're trying to get off the hook. They're squirming and they're trying to get off the hook by pointing a finger at Jesus' heritage instead of looking at what he's trying to teach them. Similar story is found in Matthew chapter 13. In Matthew 13, starting in verse 54 and reading into verse 56. He came to his hometown and began to teach the people in their synagogue, so that they were astounded and said, where did this man get this wisdom and these deeds of power? Is not this the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary? And are not his brothers James and Joseph and Simon and Judas? And are not all his sisters with us? Where then did this man get all of this? And they took offense at him.
They took offense at him more or less.
That's right, Wesley. They took offense because he, a lowly carpenter's son, in their eyes a peon, and not even on their level. The Sadducees from the Sanhedrin were the upper class.
And people today do the same thing. If you try to, if you and I agree, you talking about something that you express a little bit of knowledge that they don't have, then they'll talk about you even today.
Yeah, they'll do that. Human nature.
Yeah.
The Pharisees were the middle class guys to upper middle class, and here Jesus, as a carpenter's son, is not maybe even barely lower middle class. And so, you know, they're raising questions about his heritage, trying to get themselves off the hook, because what Jesus has been addressing is their belief or unbelief. And that's made them uncomfortable. Now, we do have to admit that John does not contain any doctrine of the virgin birth. In the Gospel of John, there is no conception or doctrine of the virgin birth. So he doesn't counter the question here of Jesus' parentage. But in the Gospel of John, in Matthew and Luke, you've got the virgin birth and the virginal conception. In the Gospel of John, he goes back even further. The writer of the Gospel of John goes back to the preexistence of Jesus, even before the birth. So he doesn't address the parentage here. But I think we also see in this the difference between human expectations and the redemptive plan of God. Human expectations, oh well, if you don't have the right heritage, the right lineage, and especially back then, if you didn't have the right lineage, then you were a nobody and you got nowhere. And so they're thinking Jesus is uppity. He's trying to get outside of his upbringing. People don't talk about the tracks these days, but growing up, we talked about people who lived on the other side of the tracks. You know, you came from the wrong side of the tracks. Even the Billy Joe Royal song, which maybe one or two of you know, Down in the Boondocks. People put me down because that's the side of town I was born in. You know, the wrong side of the tracks, the wrong area. And that's what they're saying here. They're saying, wait a minute, this guy's challenging us. And he's actually, Jesus is making a lot of sense with the common folks. The religious leaders are jealous, on the other hand, and he has taken them on and said, you know, you folks are not doing what you should. You're not responding to God as religious leaders should respond to God. You don't have the understanding, and you're not seeking the understanding. You're simply trying to do what you want to do, and that's it. And so when they start squirming because Jesus has them nailed, the first thing they do is turn to his heritage to try and discredit him. So, on the surface, as well as I think, in a simplistic nutshell, that's what this particular verse means. However, I think we have to look a little more at the surrounding context as well to see where this comes from and where he is going to. Rather than face their status, they turn to a problem that is real, but not of their own personal concern, or at least that's what they think, although it is part of their personal concern, because they're not following and they're not believing because of this bias that they have. They mutter at Jesus because he claims to be the bread that came down from heaven and try to turn the tables on him. Basically, what they're saying is, we know his father and mother, and we can't believe that any human would dare come up with this kind of blasphemy. Because also in their theology and their understanding, God would not sully himself or would not lower himself to become human. That would be an affront to God. And yet here we've got one who in the Gospel of John very clearly claims to be God in the flesh. He equates himself and his actions with the nature of God. There are a number of sayings in the Gospel of John that you don't find other places. The ego I me, or I am sayings. And every one of them identifies Jesus with some aspect of the nature of God. It's not, I'm like this, but I am. Here in John 6, verse 35, Jesus said to them, I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never be hungry, and whoever believes in me will never be thirsty. And so he says, I am that life-giving bread that is part of the nature of God. In John chapter 10, verse 11, we find the second of those I am statements. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. How does that go with God and the nature of God? Well, today, and probably the most familiar psalm out of the whole Psalter, and we read it regularly, we recite it, we learn it when we're children, we read it at the graveside today. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Equating, once again, Jesus here is saying, I am that good shepherd. He is equating himself with the nature, the very nature of God. In chapter 11, verse 25, we have the third of these I am sayings. I could probably just give you the setting and you could tell me what he says. It's the setting with the raising of Lazarus. And Martha comes and says, you know, I know that he'll rise again at the last day. And Jesus said to her, I am what? That's right. I am the resurrection and the life. All of these terms, by the way, in one way or another, in the Old Testament, refer to God. And here Jesus is equating himself with the very nature of God. In chapter 14 of the Gospel of John, chapter 14 and verse 6, as we read today. My Father's house are many dwelling places, etc., mansions or rooms. Lord, how do we know? We don't know where you're going, Thomas said, and how can we know the way? And Jesus said, I am. That's right. The way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. And the final of those I am statements is made in chapter 15, verse 1. I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine grower. And he repeats that in verse 5 of chapter 15. I am the vine, and you are the branches. But the key I am statement, equating him with the nature of God, is in verse 1. I am the true vine. So, Jesus, this one that they could feel, could touch, could see, they saw him eat, they saw him get tired, this human starts saying, I am the bread of life. I am that which gives you life and continues to give you life because God has sent me. And you know, how dare he do such? We know where you're from. We know your dad and your mom. We know your brothers and your sisters. We know what town you're from. How dare you do such? But they're doing that to try and turn him away from the finger he's just pointed at them for their unbelief. Because if we look at verses 35 and following, Jesus said to them, because they had asked earlier for the bread from heaven, and he said, I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never be hungry. Whoever believes in me will never be thirsty. But I said to you that you have seen me, and yet you don't believe. Everything that the Father gives me will come to me, and anyone who comes to me I will never drive away. For I have come down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me. And this is the will of him who sent me, that I should lose nothing of all that he has given me, but raise it up on the last day. So what he's done here is he said, look, and he says in the next verse, and I'll give them eternal life. You see, how can you look at me? How can you see what I've done? How can you listen to my teachings and not know? not believe. And you're the religious leaders, and you don't understand? So when he does that, they retreat back into their narrow way of viewing things. In their minds, they assume that divine revelation was to come in one of two ways if it came from Messiah or Son of Man. The ultimate divine revelation would either come in the earthly king that would set up the earthly political king of God, and that's what they expected out of Messiah, or the Son of Man that would come on the clouds of glory. Now, in the Hebrew Scriptures, in the Old Testament, and in their understanding, for most of them, those were two separate individuals. One was an earthly king, Messiah. One was a heavenly ruler, Son of Man. And in most of the Old Testament passages where Son of Man, early in it, Son of Man means simply human beings. But later in some of the apocalyptic passages, and in Ezekiel and Daniel and some other places, Son of Man is a reference to the heavenly figure that would usher in the heavenly rule of God after the earthly Messiah had established that kingdom on earth. So they thought, there's no way that this man that we can see and touch and see him get hungry and see him get sweaty can be this figure here. God wouldn't do that. So they expected there to be a greater manifestation. They couldn't see the forest for the trees. The trees being that which they wanted to see and with which they were comfortable and familiar, instead of the whole picture, the forest. Their objection is that since Jesus' parentage is known and seems to be normal, then he cannot be the divine instrument of God's revelation. And they cannot reconcile that earthly heritage with his divine claim. I am the bread that came down from heaven. But what happens here? Jesus, rather than addressing that and defending his parentage, returns once again to the questions of understanding God and believing or not believing, accepting everlasting life through the bread or turning it away. They're trying to sidetrack him with that aspersion. He doesn't get sidetracked, but he continues on. He returns to the true nature of belief and openness. And basically, he states that they don't need to argue about that question, for the question of incarnation really can never be fully settled by intellectual discussions or family trees. It's something we have to experience and determine to accept or not. Rather, Jesus goes back to his earlier teaching that belief in the Son, that is, coming to him, is the work of God that draws persons with an invitation who then accept or not. So how does God draw persons? By the way, this passage is also, what he continues to say here is also used by some to talk about predestination. But that's not the case here. If you study it within context, Jesus says to them, "Do not complain among yourselves. No one can come to me unless drawn by the Father who sent me, and I will raise that person up on the last day. It is written in the prophets, and they shall be taught by God. Everyone who has heard and learned from the Father comes to me. Not that anyone has seen the Father except the one who is from the Father. He has seen the Father. Very truly I tell you, whoever believes has eternal life. I am the bread of life. Your ancestors ate the manna in the wilderness and they died. But this is the bread that comes down from heaven so that one may eat of it and not die. I am the living bread that came down from heaven. Whoever eats of this bread will live forever. And the bread that I will give you for the life of the world is my flesh." So, Jesus says, how do they come? How do people come to me and accept this bread of life and live an everlasting life? Those who believe and who come to Him are in possession of that life. In contrast to those who, these religious leaders, say, well, you know, our forefathers ate the manna in the desert. And it kept them alive, yes. It kept them alive for a while, but they died. Those who come to the living bread, though, will live forever. Why? Because the living bread is alive forever. It's interesting to note that all the key words in this passage, verses 47 and following, all the key words, bread, life, come down from heaven, manna, belief, eternal life, death, only find their real meaning in connection with Jesus as the living bread. Another key, I think, though, is this statement, they will be taught by God in verse 45. Which implies that God's teachings extend to all. Nobody is excluded from God's offer to teach them. But God's instructions must be accompanied by a response of listening and learning, or it won't be effective. God doesn't force His teaching upon us. God gives us those teachings. It is incumbent upon us to accept them or reject them. And if we accept them, if we allow ourselves to be taught and we listen and learn and respond properly, then we will come to Him. But God also gives us the opportunity not to respond. Dr. Wilbert Howard writes, "We must have a teachable disposition if we are to understand and find redemption and growth." We must have a teachable disposition to understand and find redemption and growth. These religious leaders did not have a teachable disposition. Their idea was they already knew it. They just wanted somebody to reiterate that they knew it. What I think Jesus is saying here is that it doesn't matter about His supposed earthly parentage, that He is God incarnate, and that the only way we can not only learn that and find everlasting life, but the way that we can grow in His kingdom and in His way is only if we will allow God to teach us. God doesn't force it. We have to have a teachable disposition. We have to make a conscious decision to listen and learn. And if we respond by listening and learning from those teachings, we will come to Jesus. We will be accepted by Him. It's not that God draws only the elect, those whom God has elected to be saved. It's that God draws to Christ those who will listen and learn and be teachable. So it's not a doctrine of predestination, but a doctrine that emphasizes the necessity of responding to God's hope and God's desire for us. How can we come truly to know God and be saved then? Jesus says, only through Christ's manifestation of God and coming to Him and His teachings. The Pharisees believed that the wisdom of God was mediated through the law. And in fact, in Proverbs 9:5, the law is likened to bread. But Jesus dared to put Himself above this as the one who could finally nourish, finally satisfy, and finally bring life. So, what does this mean? This means that not only when the scribes and Pharisees found themselves uncomfortable when faced by Jesus' teachings of belief and unbelief, that they looked for ways to cast aspersion on Him and get themselves off the hook. It also means that sometimes when we do not have a teachable disposition, we can do the same thing. Maybe not questioning Jesus' heritage or whether Jesus has come down as the living bread out of heaven, but cutting ourselves off from greater understandings and greater growth because we squirm trying to get off the hook. Or we squirm because we don't understand. And rather than try to understand and try to dig deeper, it seems more expedient. Notice I said seems. It seems more expedient to turn the other way and to walk away from the teaching, thinking that we already know it. So, I hope that that gets to the person's question about what does this mean. I hope that it also gives us, I had not run across Wilbert Howard's comment until this afternoon, so it gave me an opportunity to learn something or to pick up another phrase, which I think is important, that we must have a teachable disposition in order to understand and find redemption and growth, as well as a couple of other things. So I will entertain any questions or comments that you might have. If you do, we can do that. If not, we'll move along. Well, since I am prone to running long on these nighttime things, and it's only 6:38, unless someone has a question, I won't let anybody stone you. As I said, we've only got two or three more questions back there, and I have a big one down in my office that I pulled last Wednesday. We will not have this session next Sunday night since we have revival with Stephen Clyburn on Sunday night. And don't miss the first one, because it will set the tone, not only set the tone, but it will pique your interest when he begins. Trust me. And he'll be singing too. We'll draw another one out after that, and we'll deal with the big question I've got downstairs as well as any others that you might have. And I thank you for this, and for coming and for sharing and for being here, and I hope that it's beneficial. Because only in that can we truly find the instruction that we need. As you go, may you find rest this evening. May you find renewal for tomorrow. And may you face the questions of tomorrow with the hope and the assurance of God's presence. God bless you. Go in peace. Amen.